You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Monday, May 15th, 2023. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Associate Professor of History at Wayne State University, Kidada E. Williams, author of I Saw Death Coming, A History of Terror and Survival in the War Against Reconstruction. Also on the program today, Biden's coming cave on the debt ceiling will be more than a political disaster. Border crossings drop as Biden's new policy strands thousands. Turkish election heads to a runoff as Elon Musk censors the Turkish opposition via Twitter. But Erdogan asked him to. Florida looking to use radioactive material outlawed by the EPA for 30 years in their road work. That's not a joke. State Department freezes green cards. Could seriously devastate health care in this country. The 163rd Pennsylvania House special race getting national attention. Philly suburbs, folks. If you're there, make sure you vote tomorrow. Latino truckers may stage a boycott over Florida's Show Me Your Papers law. Governor Cooper vetoes the North Carolina abortion ban. Now we'll see if the lawmakers override that veto. Vice files for bankruptcy. Florida teacher investigated for showing a Disney film in class. A lot of Florida news today. That's what you get out of those authoritarian states.
The Florida Report.
I'm sorry, it just happened. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks for joining us. Emma is on special assignment at one of her close friends' weddings. I mean, we're not trying to bust any news there, but that's what
if there's some news there, she'll
be on it.
Should gather it though.
Yeah, apparently, in the left media space, weddings is a very big topic.
It's big news.
Oh my god. Anyways, thanks for joining us. We have no sound clip for this that's worth playing. Anyways, in terms of the debt ceiling stuff, I mentioned this on Friday. Really, over the past couple of days, to the extent that the debt ceiling is mentioned, I've seen it mentioned in two places in the media. One is in that radio I listened to in the morning to see how the AP is reporting it, and in just the way they were reporting this like a week ago. Debt crisis, as if it's not a completely manufactured crisis. This is not a crisis in the sense that it is like a crisis has evolved. No, this is the Republican Party attempting to leverage the debt ceiling to impose cuts on basically programs that keep people from being malnourished, unhoused. I mean, I could just go down the list. And on the other hand, we have a Democratic Party, or at least the leadership of the Democratic Party, refusing to approach this attempt by the Republicans in the most common sense way possible, which is to say, you know what? The 14th Amendment says that we don't even have to pay attention to this. There's no hearings here. Or we could mint the platinum coin. There's many other things.
Tax rich people.
You do not need Joe Manchin to sign off on this like you did in December. You just simply need the administration to say, you know what, we're just not going to play along with this. And instead, and there's some people who say like, oh, well, they're doing this on purpose because they want to make these cuts. The Democrats do. I mean, I don't think that they're concerned enough about being forced to make these cuts, but I don't think they would have made these cuts on their own. There's just simply, there's no logic to it. Why pass a bill that would increase these budgets and then allow them to go back? There's no political benefit to this. And certainly, like, Wall Street only cares about the debt ceiling being raised, period, end of story. And if we did it through the 14th Amendment, they'd react in the exact same way. And the reason why I'm talking about this as a cave, or the only other place I saw this was some Instagram thing where like some like a financial guy who looked like he was like 22 was trying to get people to subscribe to his channel and was talking about the debt ceiling as if it's like the secret thing that's happening. And if it's a secret thing that's happening, it's because the Democrats have not been able to message this. And really, if they can't message it to their voters, it has no political value to them one way or another. You simply let the Republican Party take the responsibility for this. And they for creating supposedly this massive economic, and I say supposedly because I do think it will, you know, if we somehow don't pay our debt, yes, it will create an economic disaster. But the way that we can resolve that is by just paying our debt and saying that we have the authority to do so under the 14th Amendment. Ryan Cooper over at the American Prospect this morning wrote a good piece on what the implications are if Biden signs on to this two-year spending cap. Now, we don't know exactly what's being negotiated, but I can tell you what I read in Politico. As a reminder, plenty needs to be hashed out, because they're talking about, like, there's positive signs from the debt ceiling talks. One, the duration of any spending caps. Not whether there's going to be spending caps, but rather the duration of any spending caps. Remember when Biden said, I want a clean debt ceiling bill? What he was really saying is, I want to pretend like we have a clean debt ceiling bill. And then I will okay some spending caps. Two, how much unspent COVID money to claw back? Three, the substance of the permitting deal. That is Joe Manchin coming back in. He couldn't get it into the IRA. Remember that deal he had made, and they were going to give it a vote, and they gave it a vote, and it got shot down. Now he's going to stick it into this bill.
Who also, I mean, announced last week that, you know, if he doesn't get what he wants here with how the IRA is being implemented, will block all new EPA nominees.
Right. Work requirements for Medicaid, and Biden's supposedly going to hold the line there, although he bragged about how I was in favor for it during the Clinton welfare reform, which everyone universally agrees was garbage. I mean,
it's so
horrible.
Sick that we have this budget thing and we're going to bounce it off of things like that. It's just really perverse.
And just the term in which this debt ceiling is going to be raised. I mean, this is just insanity. So, okay, here is what happens if we get those spending caps. Ryan Cooper. If you cut discretionary spending to the level of fiscal year 2022, cap the rate of increase at 1% per year for an indeterminate period, maybe 2 years. This is what's being floated. This is what it would do. I mean, aside from politically saying, hey, if you can hold these hostages, we've just given another year where we allowed this, you know, we didn't go with the 14th Amendment, we didn't go with the platinum coin, which is basically saying, like, this is ripe for the pickings every time. Again, we don't know all the details, but as Ryan Cooper writes, returning to fiscal year 2022 budget levels would mean an immediate cut of 13% to every government agency and program. If defense and border cops are exempted from that cross-the-board cut, then the cut will be closer to 22%. Representative Rosa DeLauro, Connecticut, on the House Appropriations Committee, solicited estimates from various government departments on what a 22% cut would mean. 60,000 people would not be able to attend college. 200,000 children would get kicked off Head Start. 100,000 families would lose child care. 1.2 million would be removed from WIC nutrition assistance. 125 air traffic control towers would be shut down. Rail safety inspections would be cut back by 11,000 workdays. 30,000 miles of track going uninspected. 640,000 families would lose rental assistance. 430,000 more would be evicted from Section 8 housing. That's just a sampling. I mean, to the extent that there is any like really outcry about this, it's coming from Democrats in the House, and there's just not much going on in terms of supporting these this. I know every time I have a conversation with, and I feel like once a weekend, I have a conversation with somebody where I talk about we cut child poverty 35-40% in 2021 to 2022.
And you wonder why that's not plastered everywhere.
You hear
neon signs.
Zero about it.
Because the donors don't like it. Like,
right. Talk about low-hanging fruit. Right? We're not talking anything really structural here at all. We're not talking about, you know, some type of like, you know, marginal group of people that it's somehow, you know, controversial. We're talking about child poverty. Like this, like, I, honestly, like you could come up with something that sounds even more sort of beleaguered. I don't know, you know, sick puppies or something, but I don't know. That's arguable.
Yeah.
But we just don't have a body politic in this country that seems to care about it.
Well, I mean, I think it's that, like, the leaders of the party, they want it. Like, they can say all they want, but we got rid of it, and then they have it again now. And that was a policy decision. Because, like, I think, and look, I know that the Democrats wouldn't have done this unless forced to, but they don't, I don't think they genuinely care. Like, yeah. How is this easier to do than raise taxes?
the assumption always should be, and always is, that they don't care. It is that they have a constituency that does in some instances,
right.
And they force them to do the right thing. That is the way to look at politics. It's not whether you like this person, you like, or you can trust this person or whatnot. You can't make those assessments. All you can do is you have politicians who get their votes from one pool or another pool. And if you vote from that pool, your actions can, not necessarily, can influence the actions of those politicians. They will de-emphasize things they don't want pressure on. There's just no constituency in this country that cares enough to defend children who are in poverty to make enough people aware of it that it becomes an issue. And, you know, I don't know the solution to that. I mean, I don't know how many times a week I bring this up.
Because there's like this countervailing stuff in states where, like, you know, Minnesota, different states passing these, North Dakota actually getting around to it again, even despite Republicans controlling that stuff, the Democrats are pushing it again. And like, that does seem to be good politics on a state level. I just don't know why national. And I saw Ilhan, and they proposed some stuff too with regards to school lunches. Like, we should be massively expanding this stuff.
Without a doubt.
It should be good politics. But
without a doubt. I mean, it could be good politics. It's just I don't know. To the extent that there is anything on the left that is happening, from the center left to the far left, there's just no focus on this. Now, you know, frankly, if everybody listening to this program was a self-avowed communist, I'd be like, well, you know, all right, you're not engaging in necessarily these day-to-day issues. You want structural change, period, the end of story. There's a lot of people who don't really care or think about structural change, and you would think that cutting child poverty. Like, we did it.
That's a structural.
It was easy. It was easy. I mean, it was easy. It was literally easy.
And that cuts the stakes for any sort of future, like, labor action. So, like that would be a structural change to, like, get rid of the fact that we sentence children to poverty in this country if their parents don't find the right boss.
It's insane. It's insane. You know, keep an eye on this debt ceiling thing because it's just going to immiserate more people. And, you know, Biden claimed that he learned a rule from the Obama administration. I don't know what they think they get out of this politically to pretend like they did and then they don't. It's just there's a tremendous amount of incompetence. Wasn't there a new House minority leader elected? Does he still exist?
He's touring.
Is he going on tour?
Yeah.
Summer concert season, so maybe he's just, I don't know, following Fish or something like that. Is that Hootie and the who are those guys?
Dead and Co. Or Fish?
Yeah, Dead and Co. It's the final year, I think, for their tour. Couple of words from our sponsors today. Over the past, like, 6 months, Saul has decided that he will actually eat more varied food than just like a hot dog. That was basically it. We went for like months where it was just like every meal he wanted a hot dog. That was it. And I don't know if it was a function of like HelloFresh helped in some way, or I don't know if what the cause and effect was, but I am now making more meals at home, and it is a challenge to do so. Obviously, I got a full-time job. Two kids, they don't have to clean up after themselves. But HelloFresh has made it significantly easier. With HelloFresh, you get farm fresh, pre-portioned ingredients and seasonal recipes delivered right to your doorstep. The beauty of this is I don't have to do as much shopping. And these HelloFresh recipes, not only are they delicious, frankly, and kid-friendly, they also are significantly easier. I have tried other services in the past, and one of them was a sponsor. The food was fine. It was good, actually. But HelloFresh has all sorts of different variations. But the thing is, it's easy. Like, these things take 20, 25 minutes. There's not a lot of, I don't have to do like, you know, I don't have to have like knife skills. Flavors in bloom at HelloFresh. You got Taste of Spring with chef-crafted recipes featuring ripe seasonal ingredients delivered right to your door. HelloFresh does more than just delicious dinners. You can take your pick from 40 weekly recipes. You can also choose from over 100 items to round out your order, from snacks and easy lunches, desserts, pantry necessities. Everything arrives in one box on the delivery day you choose. There's so much control over this. Super easy, because there are certain days where I can make lunch and certain days when I cannot, not lunch, dinner. You don't have to call for takeout. They have quick and easy meals. They got a one pan. I can't remember. It's like a chicken tortellini bake. One pan. You know what that means? Less cleaning. Yes. And I don't have to go to the grocery store. But they have all sorts of different meals. They've got, you know, I'm trying to think if I can remember. They had like a pork bulgogi that the kids liked. They have like a quesadillas. I mean, this stuff, it's quick too. And it's delicious. Go to HelloFresh.com/majority16. Use code majority16 for 16 free meals plus free shipping. That's HelloFresh.com/majority16. America's number one meal kit. Check it out, folks. You will not be disappointed. Makes it easier. Also, just a quick reminder, CedarSeeds.com. Enter the numbers 420 at checkout, and you will get 20% off your entire order. There's also a loyalty program. For every $10 spent, you get a point. For every 10 points, you get 15% off at checkout. Wonder if we could have made that more convoluted. But it doesn't matter. You get a free packet of Maestro, too, if you get up to 25 points. Still time to get those seeds in the ground. There's a grow guide there. Check it out. That deal will end tonight at 11:59 p.m. So use the coupon code 420. It's, you know, those plants that we don't mention their name because...
Censorship.
All right, going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to be talking to Professor Kidada Williams, professor of history, associate professor of history at Wayne State University, author of I Saw Death Coming, A History of Terror and Survival in the War Against Reconstruction. We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program Kidada E. Williams. She's an associate professor of history at Wayne State University, author of her second book. I believe it's her second, right? I Saw Death Coming, A History of Terror and Survival in the War Against Reconstruction. Professor, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Let's just start. I mean, the phrasing of the war against Reconstruction is an attempt by you to as a corrective for the way that we often talk about Reconstruction, and certainly, you know, prior to 20 some odd years ago, almost exclusively perceived Reconstruction as a function of the Dunning School. Tell us a little bit about the Dunning School. I mean, I think, you know, this audience is fairly well versed, but let's just go over this because I think this is important and why this is a corrective.
Well, what the Dunning School essentially does is takes up the argument made by ex-Confederates after they overthrew Reconstruction. And what they said is that Reconstruction failed. And the sort of larger part of that story is that they said, you know, they were unfairly punished for starting the war. White Northerners put unqualified, ignorant Black people in control of the South, and those Black people harmed white people. And so white Southerners had no choice but to overthrow this unjust government and do that with the Ku Klux Klan and then install the system of Jim Crow. So that's the narrative that ex-Confederates created. And the Dunning School essentially turns that into or plays a role in helping that become like the major narrative, the major propaganda of U.S. history after the Civil War. And so what I wanted to do was I understood that that was the narrative that people got. I understood that that was the story that some historians are telling, or it's part of a shorthand that historians are using even today. But those historians who are using that narrative of failure today, what they mean when you press them on it, they mean the federal government failed to protect African Americans' rights. But if they're not explicit when they say Reconstruction failed, then the larger public is filling in the gaps with that narrative from Reconstruction. And they believe that civil rights, equality, the vote, etc., were wasted on Black people.
And I should just say the Dunning School came out of Columbia. Dunning, his first name escapes me, but it was
William
Dunning. And there were other historians sort of in his sphere out of Columbia, and I imagine other schools. But this is in the 1920s, which is not really a coincidence in terms of that era. We'll catch up to that. But it just I have to say that, like, you know, over the past, 6, 7, 8 years. On this program, like, you know, I've come to understand Reconstruction in a way that I barely even heard about it in high school. I mean, it really was not even, I don't even know if I actually ever heard about it in high school. Even in college, it was at that time in the 80s, it was barely spoken of, in any way. And then this notion of failure also, by the time it gets to like a broader audience. Like you say, there's such a passive quality to it that it almost didn't catch. And but over the years, we've heard so much from different historians about the coups that took place here. What you've done is actually gone in and found the records of families' testimony so that it takes it right down to sort of like where the rubber meets the road with these things. Let's talk about these sources for these records. The most prominent was a series, I guess the official title was the Joint Select Committee to Inquire on the Condition of Affairs in Late Insurrectionist States. Is that right?
And that's correct.
And it's basically, though, it was like talking, and this happened in 1871. So give us the context of what led to that, because I think it becomes clear through your work here that the story of the Civil War ending and it ends, and some people are mad about it, some people are not. It really just is more of a story of like the war shifts to almost like a guerrilla war.
Right. So part of what happens is that wars never end as neatly in real life as they appear in history books. Right. And so what we get is that the war ended. And what we don't acknowledge is that wars are often followed by new conflicts. And, you know, I think the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq should tell us about what happens when the war is officially over and like what happens afterwards. So after the Civil War, the new conflict is about African-Americans enjoying these civil and political rights. And I think we need to understand that because ex-Confederates and enslavers only release Black people from bondage in order to end the war, right? So it's not something that they want to do. It's not something that they do happily. And what we see is them immediately shift to trying to hold on to as much of slavery as possible. And some of this looks like killing, slaughtering people who are trying to leave farms and plantations, killing Black veterans when they return from the battlefield to go get their families out of bondage. They often have to fight their way in order to recover their people who were legally, technically free. But that's because you've got those former enslavers who are still holding on to slavery. And so what they do is they start to declare essentially war on Black people who are seizing their freedom. And so the difference that we have to understand is that while Black people were in bondage, it wasn't profitable to just kill them all willy-nilly, right? You can continue sort of using different types of violence against them, but you weren't going to kill them. In an era where they now have, they're legally free, they have rights, and they're acting on those rights, you can turn on them and massacre them at will. And so that's part of what we see in terms of that war that I argue follows the Civil War. And what we have are African Americans reporting this violence to army officials, to the Freedmen's Bureau. They're writing members of Congress. They're contacting the president. They're like letting their state officials know. They're reporting it to anyone who would listen. And these dispatches continue making their way up the chain of command. And eventually, you get members of Congress who say, we need to look at what's happening here. Even the generals are reporting that there is a lot of violence going on. And so what Congress decides is to form a joint select committee to investigate what was happening, to investigate these claims. And that's how you get these, that's how you get this testimony. You've got about a dozen or so lawmakers from both chambers of Congress who head to these spots in the South, and they hear testimonies from elected officials, law enforcement, accused perpetrators, and their victims.
Yeah, I don't know if you get this from other people, but it's almost embarrassing to me that it is so revelatory to contemplate the post Civil War in the way that, like, you know, we've seen the violence continue in Iraq and in Afghanistan, and this occurs to me, like, of course this is what it was, but we're not conditioned, and it's almost probably because, you know, we haven't had a war in this country in 170 years now, whatever the math is. And, you know, there's not a lot of people around who can tell that story. But basically, it's they're giving up their slaves because they're the plantation owners are giving up their slaves because they're on the wrong end of a gun. But then because we don't occupy, by we, I mean the Union Army does not occupy the South, they take their guns and they go home. And then they're like, okay. And I got to imagine, too, that the assassination of Abraham Lincoln gave like a hope of like, you know what? This ain't over yet. We can turn this around. So like this wasn't just acting out. It was like we have a new agenda here and we can get back to where we were.
Exactly. And having President Johnson secede Abraham Lincoln, they essentially, you know, the former enslaving class, they say he's one of ours. He's a former enslaver himself.
He was.
Right?
Yeah.
You know, he's one of our people. And his moves initially, you know, when he comes into power, makes clear that there's going to be no consequence for secession, that they're going to get their land back. You know, the one thing they won't get back is slavery. And so what they say is that, well, you know, we may not be able to get it back in the exact form as we had it before. But what we'll do is we will try to do as much as we can to resurrect this old system. And that's essentially what they're able to do. And as you know, because of the lack of military occupation, you know, you do have some forces within the U.S. South, but one of the realities you have to deal with is that the war is officially over. Americans dating back to the Boston Massacre don't take well to a standing army in peacetime. And so you've got a lot of people are saying, well, the war is over. So we shouldn't have a standing army. The soldiers want to go home. There are all of these things. And there's a political investment in moving on from the war. So the Army's footprint is shrinking every single year. And so there are never enough troops in the region and where the violence is happening in order for them to do anything about the violence. And ex-Confederates are strategic. They're not striking in areas where there are large numbers of troops.
And I want to get to those strikes too, but it also sort of like it also contextualizes like the value of maintaining some ambiguity in the context of the 15th Amendment, in the context of the 13th Amendment, and the 14th Amendment. Though that ambiguity, if it's seen in part as a, like this war is not over, you know, like we can't have exactly what we had before, but we can have the same sort of like structure. Like you say, they're avoiding the conflict. It's a guerrilla war they're fighting, essentially against freed black people and, yeah. Their political power. So I just want one more on how the committee forms, and then we'll get into sort of the substance of what initiated that, because we're talking 6 years after the end of the official end of the Civil War. That committee, is that with Johnson sort of stifling, you know, any of the sort of like real, I guess, more dramatic things that the radical Republicans want to do? This committee feels like, well, this is the power that we have and we're going to exercise it. And they actually go, this is not a committee that happens in Washington. This is a fact-finding committee that tell us a little bit about that, and then we'll get into some of these stories and what was the impetus for these committees.
Right. So, you know, you've got lawmakers who go to places like Jacksonville, Mississippi. They go to Spartanburg, South Carolina, Jacksonville, Florida, I should say, Spartanburg, South Carolina, Macon, Mississippi. They go to Atlanta. So they go to these places that are in the South, to collect these testimonies. And I think the thing we have to keep in mind is that you've got not only both chambers, but members of both parties who go to the South. And so you've got progressives, some abolitionists, moderates, and white conservatives in the North and West. So they often go, everyone's kind of going with their own agenda because right. They had fought in the process of establishing the committee about who was going to be able to go, what they were investigating. And you can look at the congressional record to see where people stand, because there are a lot of members of Congress who don't believe the violence is happening. So they're essentially, there's nothing that generals can tell them about the violence that's happening that will convince them, because they're invested as white conservatives in a very particular kind of post-Reconstruction, a post-Civil War reconstruction of the nation. And so there's nothing that they will hear that will convince them that white Southerners are targeting Black people. And we see that in the questions they ask. We see that in the report that they write, et cetera. So you do have a very diverse group of lawmakers who go south to investigate the violence that's happening.
Okay. And so what was the impetus for, like, I imagine that that cohort of lawmakers you're talking about is sort of like, I don't know, you know, if they had put Jim Jordan on the impeachment committee for Trump, I mean, that his job would be to be an obstacle to the committee doing its work. What was the impetus, though, for the committee? So I know why the Jim Jordans of that era would have gone on that roadshow. What was the impetus, though? Like, it was just that they were hearing from different and what was the agenda beyond taking the record? Like, what was the thinking of the lawmakers as to, like, how we're going to apply this information?
Right. So I think part of what we have is they're getting a steady stream of reports. And one dimension of the reports is not only just that they are deliberately targeting Black people, but they are interfering with elections. And so they are interfering with the democratic process. And there's the belief that if they are disrupting elections, if they are denying people the right to vote, that they must take action, that Congress must take action in order to address this. And in reality, in assassinating voters at the polls, in assassinating lawmakers, in attacking people for trying to vote, in trying to bribe elected officials to leave office, and then trying to assassinate them if they refuse, that there is clear disorder in the election process. And so the idea is that if they will go and they can collect this information and understand what's really happening, that maybe they can bolster the number of troops in the region in order to secure the elections that are happening in the South as those governments reconstruct themselves.
Do we have, like, I'm right now, I just, and it really came from, like, a listener sent me, you know, a list of what we know in terms of, like, massacres that took place. I mean, we've talked about on this program the Wilmington massacres. I think we've talked about Colfax and, Tulsa and a couple others. We don't even really know how many there were. And by massacres, we're talking, like, could be hundreds, could be 25. I mean, you know, I would imagine, too, like, the efficacy of this thing is if they can kill that guy and that guy, we're not safe. Yeah. Like, if they can kill the guy who was mayor or, you know, state rep, they can certainly kill me. And so I'm either going to, chilling effect is almost not even the word, but do we have any, like, real sense in the documents, in the testimony that's there? Do we start to hear more numbers than the historical record has? Because I imagine there are a lot of places where this stuff dies out because nobody's talking about it. Nobody reports it. Maybe, you know, Black families leave and they don't talk about it. Or if they do, it gets lost in, you know, over the generations. Do we have a good sense of, like, how many people were killed during these 5 or 6 years in this form of violence?
So the truth of the matter is that we don't. And for the reasons that you explained, like, we've got the major massacres, like, that happened in Memphis, and that happened in New Orleans. But what you have are a lot of mass killing events. And so no one's necessarily doing the counting. The people who may be witnesses are killed and they're driven off. We do have a lot of Union military officials are saying there are too many to count. We don't know. And that's as early as 1868. They're saying there are too many to count. And we know this violence continues clear up until Wilmington. And so we do have one figure, and that's by Robert Smalls. He was an enslaved man who escaped during the Civil War, and he served in the army, and then he goes to become a lawmaker. And in the late 1890s, he estimates that there are about 54,000 killed.
Wow.
From the end of the Civil War through the late 1890s. And we have no idea how he came up with that figure. But when you talk to historians who are looking at the records and you're like, mass killing here, mass killing there, the EJI has come up with 2,000 during that short period. And that's what they're calling lynchings. That's not including all of the other kinds of violence that resulted in death and that injury and then death. And so when you look at all of the records and you look at this, the sort of period of time, you can say, we don't know how he came up with that figure, but it kind of tracks. We would be, you know, it would be like very surprising to find him completely wrong. Now, he may have been looking at reports that were coming in to the Department of Justice. He may have been gathering all of his data from a lot of Black organizations like the Colored Conventions that were meeting every year. And in these convention records, you've got that regular reports from local communities about how many people had been killed. So again, we don't know exactly how he came up with this figure, but we know that it's definitely in the thousands. During Reconstruction, and especially if you track Reconstruction to the end of the 19th century, the number is significantly larger.
Right. I mean, so the Wilmington massacre essentially takes place in 1898 in North Carolina, and you're basically looking at almost like a 30-year war, like a 30-year. I don't know what, you know. It's not a Cold War. It's not necessarily a hot war. It's like a guerrilla war essentially waged across this, and the feds are nowhere to be seen except for in that 1871 hearings. And what comes out of those hearings, well, let's get to that in a moment. Let's talk about a little bit about what you found and from different families. I don't know if there's a couple of stories that whether it's like the Crosby family or the Tutson family or which, you know, but maybe tell us a story of one or two of those families that give us a sense of like the range of how things were, this war of intimidation, I guess, or attempt to recapture some form of slavery.
So I'll start with the Tutsons in Florida. They, at the end of the war, they managed to work hard, save up their money, and they get on a homestead. And as soon as they get onto the land, their white neighbors try to drive them off of it. And what they say is, you know, we have rightful access to this land. We have worked hard. We've done what we're supposed to do. We're not leaving it. So they, you know, they had been offered bribes, they'd been intimidated, and the wife, Hannah Tutson, says, we're not leaving our land. And, you know, she says, I don't care what they do to me as long as we keep our land. We've worked too hard for this. And so they're committed to not leaving. And one night, in the middle of the night, a group of armed white men burst into their home. They're there with their three children, and it's Hannah and Samuel, her husband, and they're there with their three young children, and it is like a home invasion. They are not prepared to be attacked. They are not prepared to defend themselves. They are quickly overpowered. Their toddler is thrown across the room, and the adults are dragged out to two separate locations, tied to trees and whipped and beaten and tortured, and Hannah Tutson is sexually assaulted. Their children flee from the home in terror and go and hide in the woods. The older daughter, she plies the baby, who's like a toddler, with blackberries to try to keep it from crying out and making noises so the men will hear them and find them. And the men tear down their home. They knock down their fences. They destroy everything they've built. And then they eventually leave. And so that example, you know, the Tutsons, they weren't doing anything to harm anyone. They weren't even necessarily voting. They were just making the most of freedom like they were supposed to. They got land. They were working the land. Hannah was working as a washerwoman, and they were attacked in order to take their property from them and to leave them with nothing. And I think in the minds of the perpetrators, it's so that Black people had nothing. They had no choice but to go back to a condition that was very similar to slavery. And so that's just one example.
And I mean, there's a couple of things I feel like that we can infer from this. That one is that this, you know, the next plot of land owned by a black family, it all they need to say is, like, you don't want to end up like the Tutsons.
Yes.
And so those people leave. It has that efficacy. And I also got to imagine that for every family like the Tutsons who is willing to testify publicly, there has to be, I don't know what the algorithm is, but X number of other families who went through the exact same thing who were afraid, like, I'm not testifying. It's going to put a target on my back. It's going to put a target on my, like, I mean, the bravery associated. I mean, that's the amazing thing about this is, like, the bravery associated with even testifying. I would, you know, like, I guess maybe it's just a sort of some notion we can trust them because they're feds, maybe. But do we have any notion of, like, if there was retribution on people who testified?
There absolutely was. Some people were attacked on their way to testifying before Congress. You know, other people, they were attacked and driven from their communities or even killed afterwards. And there are reports in subsequent congressional investigations into violence and other activity in the South that reveal, you know, the danger that people are in. People really, they are clear in understanding that testifying before the hearings or testifying before the committee puts their lives and their family lives in danger. But for a lot of the bravest witnesses, what they say is they can't imagine the alternative. You know, not trying to get justice leaves them open to future attacks. It leaves their neighbors and maybe other relatives in their community open to future attacks. So they're putting their lives on the line with the hope that they can convince lawmakers to take purposeful action to end the violence so that everyone can be free, equal, and secure.
And we should say that, you know, like, these hearings are happening close enough to the end of the war that it's almost as if there's still sort of like some hope, like, you don't know which way this trajectory is going. And we don't know how durable the desire of the plantation owner class and others, I guess, to subjugate black people, how durable that is and how durable the federal government will be or not be in that instance. Do you want to talk about maybe the Crosby family as well? I mean, just to give a sense of two different stories, and then we can go and talk about what came out of these hearings.
Right. So the Crosby family, they live just outside of Aberdeen, Mississippi. And Edward, you know, he is working, but he wants to get ahead. And he realizes that the best way to do that is to be able to vote into office people who will serve his interests. But he's still living on the land of the person who, or the family that held him in bondage. And so, you know, he's planning on voting, he's planning on exercising his rights. And his former enslaver says, if you vote away white men's power in this election, we're going to kill you. And so in this exchange, it's very clear, right? You know, Edward is worried that he may lose his life, they may be evicted, and so put out on the streets. You know, so he tells, you know, his former enslaver, now his landlord and employer, well, yes, of course, I hear you. I will not vote away your rights. And so he goes to vote. He says, you know, he's smart. He knows what to say in this meeting. But he decides to act in his own interest in the election. And he goes to try to vote. And he's told that there are no Republican ballots. There are no Republican ballots available. And so he's walking around thinking, well, I know there should be ballots. They know that this is an election. So he goes to another polling place and he's told the exact same thing. And he meets up with a group of other black men who are told the exact same thing. They've gone from polling place to polling place. And soon there are armed white men who start to surround the polling places. And what the black men know is that if they take any action, if they try to demand a ballot, that they may all be killed. And so Edward says, you know, I knew I was beat at my own game. And so he went home. And so he went home. But in the one night, he steps out in the middle of the night to get some water for his child. And he feels and hears the rumble of what turns out to be a team of horses coming towards his home. And It is white men in Klan masks, and their horses are even draped with cloth, coming to punish Edward for trying to vote in the election. And so he runs and he hides in the smokehouse, thinking that the men won't search the property. And if they do, they'll never think to go into the smokehouse. And his wife tells them when they get down from their horses that he's not there. And so the white men give up their search for Edward, but he knows that he's been marked. And he doesn't necessarily want to leave the community. He may want to leave the person who held him in bondage, but he doesn't necessarily want to leave the community because his support network is there. And he also knows it'll be very hard to convince other landlords and employers to hire him if he was planning on voting. So he believes that if he testifies before Congress, he can maybe convince lawmakers to help, you know, help lawmakers see something that he knows, which is that enslavers are doing what they can to hold on to slavery, and they're doing what they can to overthrow Reconstruction. And he really wants, for a sense of his own self-regard and value for his life and the future of his family, he wants to let lawmakers know, because he hopes and believes that a government that would abolish slavery would make sure that Black people have the ability to enjoy their freedom.
I mean, it's amazing when you just hear these two different stories of these two different families. Like, you can see through the years, the 40, 50 years, you can see the different sort of variations. If the Civil War was sort of like the most violent attempt to maintain this type of structure in society, you just start to see, as you go forward in time, these other iterations are versions of the earlier ones, but just within the constraints of that time. So the, you know, covenants to keep Black families from living in a certain area in Long Island are the version of the, you know, throwing them off the land and beating them until they leave. Right. And then, you know, making mortgage loans less accessible is just the other iteration. And then we get into just more sophisticated segregation as we go through time. And we can see the same thing with the voting. We're going to first come to you and tell you, if you vote, we're going to kill you. And then we're going to pretend like we've run out of ballots. And then we're going to have poll taxes. And then when those get, in literacy tests, when those get rescinded, then we're just going to put a series of other obstacles that are more sort of like subtle and with the same agenda, maybe not as effective as saying, I'm going to kill you, but with the same intent. So following these hearings, or is it simultaneously, there's a passage of the Enforcement Acts, which is like, it's just a reminder, we have laws, you should really enforce them. It's more or less what it could, but it's also known as the KKK Act. And I think this also, what your work here does, is it makes it clear that the KKK is not like some entity distinct from I don't want to say it's distinct from the Confederate Army, but it's almost like this is just sort of the guerrilla warfare version of the Confederate Army.
Yes.
Talk about the Enforcement Acts.
Right. So what the Enforcement Acts do is they become a mechanism for trying to enforce the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendment. And so it's very clear, you know, there are clear indications that ex-Confederates are acting to deny Black people their freedom, including their release from bondage, that they are denying them due process of law and equal protection under the law. So when Black people report this violence to local authorities, what the records reveal, and even, you know, members of the Freedmen's Bureau and U.S. Army personnel are saying, there is no justice for Black people within the legal system in the Southern states. None at all. Right now. And so And, you know, and they're clearly trying to violate not only Black men's right to vote, but their ability to serve in office after they've been elected. And so what the Ku Klux Klan Act and what the larger enforcement acts try to do is to try to address the destabilization and the undermining of the democratic process in terms of elections. So it does things like it makes it a there's a greater chance of it being a federal crime to interfere with an election. It's a crime to wear masks, et cetera, to the polls, et cetera, trying to intimidate people away from voting. So it becomes this one, it's one of many mechanisms that could be used to try to tamp down on this violence. What we also see with the Enforcement Act is the larger, what will become the Department of Justice investigation into this violence. And so you get agents sent south to investigate what's happening with these elections and what's happening in terms of the violence. And they're sending a lot of this information back to DC, letting them know that this is what's happening. And this is why we need action to be taken in order to retain the integrity of American elections.
The problem was that the enforcement acts in many respects were just simply not enforced.
Yes.
I mean, there was just no apparatus to enforce it, really.
Yes. And, you know, but also not by design. You know, I should say, but kind of by design, you know, in the sense that there, you know, if there had been the will to enforce these acts,
right,
then, you know, then that could have happened. And I think that's important to sort of acknowledge because it's not only members of Congress. You know, because Congress in the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendment, they add enforcement clauses in each one of the amendments, and Congress has the power and authority to enforce this act or enforce this amendment. But lawmakers don't act. And one of the main reasons lawmakers don't act is because of their own investments in white supremacy and their own concerns about what the end of slavery means. And they're responding to their constituents. The white majority in the North and West who also have, you know, they've got their own sort of quibbles and concerns with emancipation and what equal rights actually means. So the power to enforce the amendments is there. Congress just doesn't really act on them until the 1960s.
I mean, this is, you know, it's also instructive just like broadly speaking on how like these how government, not even just ours, I would imagine, but all work, right? Like they're taking all of these steps, which diffuse, let's say, the outrage,
yes,
the impetus to act upon them. They're taking all these steps that diffuse them. Obviously, like you're sending, they sent a lot of agents down. I think like thousands of agents down to record this stuff. So the stuff was pretty meticulously recorded. But that act lets a little air out of the tire. And then by the time it gets back into the point where you need more pressure, there's just not the will in the North at that point. Like, we did a war over this. How much more do we need to do? I mean, like, we were just talking about child poverty. We cut child poverty by 40% in the past year. And yet, there's not enough like will amongst like the constituents who would push the parties, I should say, right, the politicians to continue this program, which it's clearly we can do it. It can be done.
Right.
It really it's doesn't take that much. It exactly. doesn't take that much. And, but there's just not the will to push it. So we take this through, and I know this is sort of like goes beyond, the scope of this book, maybe, but this progresses, this dynamic progresses. And despite what we hear early on, that was like almost, you know, like the last thing you hear in terms of like someone who's drowning, right? Like the last, to the extent that they're making it, like, that's it. Like that's the biggest noise that we have. And it slowly, like, it takes over and really doesn't end until we get into Jim Crow, which is basically like we successfully stopped, you know, Reconstruction from changing the dynamics in so dramatically in our society. And now we're going to codify our position, entrench that through Jim Crow laws, which begin as that era ends, right? I mean, that's what's happening.
Right. And they also install the monuments to celebrate their victory. Right.
Well, that seems to happen almost like in phase two of Jim Crow, almost, is to edify, like, we were able to stop the black political power and wealth from happening.
Yes.
In its nascent stages over the course of 20, 30 years. We then simultaneously also codify these results in Jim Crow laws. And in, you know, we have a Supreme Court that's going to back it up. We have Plessy versus Ferguson. We also have like a whole host of rulings on voting so that we've now institutionalized this. And then we're going to culturally sort of signify this by the teens in the 20s, where the KKK, which was, you know, really like the guerrilla bands of the Confederate Army, now number like 6%, like card carrying, like the out KKK, 6% of the country at that point. What ends it? Like, I mean, obviously Jim Crow laws don't end to the 1960s, but it feels like, is it just World War II and then and the Depression, and like, does that, or is it just like, well, we've achieved a stasis that we're happy with. We've got our new equilibrium. We're good with that. And we don't need to push anything more.
I think that they had managed to completely subjugate the black population in the South. I think the other thing they managed to do was to take control over how the history was taught. Right.
This is when the Dunning School happens, exactly. At the same time that we're getting these statues, essentially.
Exactly. So you've got the Lost Cause narrative. You've got the sort of Daughters of the Confederacy taking over the education in the larger public schools, taking over the textbooks, et cetera. And then casting Reconstruction as a failure. Right. One that, you know, who needs to study a failure? Why pay any attention to it? And so you've got this sort of, they feel victory to a degree, but they also recognize that hegemony is hard work, that it requires constant vigilance, and it requires constant vigilance because Black people will not surrender their rights. They will not consistently, they will not lay down and not continue fighting for their rights. And so that's why you see, you know, even through this period, a lot of Black people suing in court, they're, you know, migrating, they're participating in the great migrations out of the South. You know, they are looking at the country sideways when the nation says in World War I and World War II, you know, are you Black people going to help? And Black people are like, why should we? And so, you know, like, the, you know, I think feel like the white population feels like they have control over the situation, but they realize that they don't, right? And that's why you see more and more that sort of blossoming of civil rights activism, and they feel like they have to tamp down even more in order to limit Black people's ability to try to fight their way out of the system. And so what eventually starts to happen is that you get more and more support, more moderate support, for what will become civil rights and support for, you know, at least in theory, a more just society. And that momentum, you see the rise of the civil rights movement. But as the civil rights movement is occurring, you've got the sort of white Southern conservative movement that is on the rise too, that is determined to tear down everything that had been achieved during a civil rights movement, very much like their predecessors had done with Reconstruction.
I mean, and so in many respects, the sort of like the conservative movement we see today, particularly as it manifests itself in a lot of these former Confederate states, is it's just a continuation of that and reacting to different facts on the ground. Because it was a 60-year project, really. I mean, a 60-year project to get to a new normal that for a brief period of time, there was this, you know, I mean, 5-year period, maybe even if, where there was a rejiggering of power, and then a 60-year program to sort of get it back to a new equilibrium that wasn't that durable. I mean, I guess, you know, that's the encouraging part.
Yeah.
Is it?
Yeah. I mean,
Emma, help me out here.
I mean, like, you know, it's hard because I think part of it is that we have to sit with the hard, dark truth of white supremacy and, you know, and the investments in it and not only by white conservatives in the South, but white conservatives in the North and West too. White Southerners couldn't have done what they did without the sort of support of white Northerners and Westerners. And so, you know,
even if it's just tacit support, if you create that vacuum, if you don't enter into that fight, you've created a vacuum. That's basically
exactly. But you also have things like Northern states saying after the, you know, with the 15th Amendment, is this going to apply to my state? Like, I'm in Michigan. So it would be the equivalent of Michigan saying, is this going to apply to us? The 15th Amendment shouldn't apply to us. We didn't secede from the war.
Right.
I mean, we didn't secede from the country. And so, you know, you've got these larger national investments in white supremacy that I think we haven't been honest about. We haven't come to terms with it. And I think a lot of Northerners and Westerners, we acknowledge the lost cause of the South, but we don't acknowledge that white Northerners and Westerners have created their own mythology, right? And in the Northern states, it's we're all abolitionists, and they weren't. You know, if they had all been abolitionists, they could have abolished slavery before. They could have abolished slavery at any time before the war. But that's not who they were.
Right. And a reminder: there was not a push to abolish slavery. I mean, it wasn't as like instrumental to the economy in the way that it was to the South. The Southern slavery may have been, but the real, like, to the extent that there was anything, any active anti-slavery or abolition, it was really in inhibiting its growth in the new Western territories.
In the Western states.
It wasn't about existing slavery at that point.
Exactly.
And we should also say, like, you know, people could be abolitionists and very often were without really, with you know, whose solution to slavery was send all black people back to Africa.
Exactly. They can walk and chew gum at the same time.
Right.
And I think that we, you know, again, this is where we again need to grapple with the hard truth of investments in white supremacy and how white supremacy works. You know, the subtle, you know, like there's the sort of hard fist of white supremacy and there's the soft, right, behind the scenes support for the same outcome, if not a willingness to sort of get out there and be on the front lines. And I think what I tried to do in the book was to help readers see how that works through violence and through support of the violence and refusal to do anything about the violence and how that makes our democracy less secure. And, you know, maybe even to serve as a warning for the reality that we're facing today.
Well, it's an incredibly important book. Kidada E. Williams, Associate Professor of History at Wayne State University. The book is I Saw Death Coming, A History of Terror and Survival in the War Against Reconstruction. Thanks so much for your time today. Really appreciate it. We'll put a link to that, obviously, in the podcast, YouTube, and website. Will be on majority.fm. Thanks so much.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
All right, folks. Going to take a quick break. Head into the fun half of the program. Really important book, I think, for people to read. Aside from the actual information, but just how it can teach you really like what history really is about. I'm embarrassed as to how I thought, like, you know, I guess it's not even you think about it. You assume the war's over. The war's over, and they're all like, "Okay, we're done. We lost." That's not the way it works.
Yeah, it's the problem with how you memorialize these things, because the Civil War is absolutely something we should memorialize. But when you say like, "Oh, look at we won," and you know, then what happened? Well, Lincoln got killed, and everyone was a little bit sad. But hey, we still won the war, and it's like
right. Well, that's the tricky thing about history, because you literally, like, you read a history book, you shut the last page, you shut the cover, and it's just too clean and the point is too that there is strong incentive of different people and ideas that travel through history to misrepresent history. And I mean, we just talked the other day about Alex Haley sort of making up that interview with Martin Luther King about Malcolm X, his perspective on Malcolm X. Like, this is the story of Reconstruction and post-Reconstruction, Jim Crow, and leading up to the Dunning School is a much broader one. But it's the same basic, you know, premise. And that's why it was so durable, I think, is because it was there was so much, so many different people, so many different ideologies invested in creating a false narrative. A lot of people probably didn't even realize it was false.
I mean, you look at the way that these things were discussed after the Civil War, and it was like the most repugnant type of like white supremacy racism, just explicit. Like, they're not ready for this, actually. Black people, like, they're not ready for civilization, and that's the way they looked at it. Like, Custer, who was a general in the Civil War, was later stationed, I believe, in Missouri or somewhere in the South, just not interested in really enforcing Reconstruction. And that's and he was sort of like, his dad was a copperhead, a Confederate supporting Northerner, they later decided, well, if we're not going to be able to use the military to basically reconstruct the South in a way that isn't white supremacist, let's just send him to the plains and have him kill Native Americans.
Well, I think it's the opposite. I think it's the idea is like, we can go and reconstruct the political dynamics in the South, or we can expand and make some cash by going west.
Exactly. We can build some trains.
Well,
got to make some money.
Got to make some cash. Speaking of which, folks, you can support this program by becoming a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you not only get the fun half, you also get the free half, free of commercials. It is your support that makes it possible for this show to survive and thrive. Become a member today. Jointhemajorityreport.com. You can also do it through the app. You should pick up the app. And when you do pick up the app and you become a member, you can IM the show. And you also, I don't know, there's a bunch of other stuff you can do. I don't know. I can't remember. Don't forget justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. See, Emma is not around to do ESVN today, following the extraordinary Celtics win, which I will remind El Conniption from the IM in the fun half, not that it's stuck in my craw, that it looks like somebody was right about the Celtics and they're peaking in the proper time.
Yeah, it was a good weekend for you, Sam, and a bad one for me. Thursday and Friday, the Devils and the Knicks were both eliminated from playoff contention. I mean, from the playoffs, so kind of happy to not do a show today to recap that. But Emma might do a remote dispatch from her time in L.A., but we'll see about that, and we will be back next week. YouTube.com/ESPN show for more clips until then.
The biggest sporting event I ever attended in my life was the 1981 Game 7. I think it was 1981 Game 7, Sixers-Celtics. Wow. Celtics won. And it was nuts. It was nuts at the Garden.
I can imagine.
It was nuts. It's the only sporting event I remember going to where we stayed until the end. Because you're in Boston and everybody's like, we're going to get out because you can't.
Traffic sucks in Boston.
Traffic sucks, and we're not going to be able to get out. It's going to take us 4 hours to get back to Worcester. Matt, what's happening on Left Reckoning?
Patreon.com/Left Reckoning. David and I did another 90 minutes for the second part of our Marx reading series on the 18th Brumaire of Louis Napoleon, which is basically Louis Napoleon Bonaparte. Taking over after the 1848 revolutions, and some different. It's interesting because it's like the first time is tragedy, second time is farce. Quote from Marx, but people look at 18th Brumaire as like a lesson for why didn't the Communist Manifesto lead to a communist revolution? But rereading it, there's as much for like American sort of Republican revolutionaries. To learn about why, say, like the National Guard that was formed by the Marquis de Lafayette eventually folded over and let Napoleon back into imperial power. So a lot of interesting history going on. Patreon.com/Left Reckoning for that.
Paul Prague says there are work stoppages and trucking boycotts over Florida's immigration policy. It's also a felony to transport undocumented workers. They're just going to ramp up arrests and expand prison labor to reignite slavery, aren't they? I mean, what's going on in Florida is just nuts. I've heard some reports, at least we've seen some stuff with Latino and particularly Spanish-speaking truck drivers saying they're going to boycott Florida. If you're down in Florida and you have firsthand experience of that, let me know. I am during the show or call. 646-257-3920 is the number. 646-257-3920. Is the number. We will take your IMs and phone calls in a moment. See you in the fun half. Left is best. Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous. You're a little bit upset. You're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude.
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 You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2. 5/8. 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd.
Don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance.
Ooh. Grandpa.
I had my first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you. You fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jab.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good. Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
You think I might be a Nazi?
Agree.
No.
Death to America.
You.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up.
Ooh. Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. Let's I wanna just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me.
Hey, shut up!
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.